Want to hear one of my favorite sounds? That's the sound I hear when I get one of the questions right on Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. I've been saying I wanted to learn another language for the longest time now, and I'm finally doing it this year with Babbel. I signed up for French because there's a lot of medical history that I'm interested in that was originally written in French. Plus, I've always wanted to travel to France, and when I finally get there, I'd like to be able to get around. Now, Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and they're rooted in real-life situations delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I actually recorded my first lesson in French. Here, take a listen. Matching au revoir to goodbye.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. When will I get the cool accent?
Bonjour.
All right. Got it. Now, that's just my first lesson, so don't judge me or my accent. But I did pick up on a few things that I thought were interesting. There's a lot of spaced repetition and cognitive flexibility being used in their lessons, and I've been pretty impressed so far with the program. The app and regular website are both super easy to use and look great, and the lessons can be done in 10 minutes or less. So far, I feel like I'm learning a lot, and we have a very special deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, babbel.com/barbellpod. That's BABBEL.com/barbellpod. There's rules and restrictions may apply, but 60% off. Check them out, guys.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength conditioning and strength conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, joined by the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baraki. What's going on, man?
Hey, man. I'm doing okay. It seems like I've had a little bit of a break, but I'm back.
Yeah, we gave you a vacation. You know, you get 2 weeks off in a 52-week calendar year, and you're back, and we're happy to have you. This is episode 184, the June research review. We've been bouncing a lot of papers back and forth, and I know the ones we've previously done, we try to cover three or four papers, but these are two what I would consider important papers that have recently come out, so we'll talk about those. Before we get into that, I mean, just give us an update. You've had like a life update, and you're not the type of person who's going to go on social media and be like, life update, you know, new home, who dis? So like you moved. What else has been going on?
Yeah, I mean, I finished up work with my last job in San Antonio, Texas, in early June, and then took a few days vacation down to the Caribbean with my wife, and then in anticipation of our move. And then we both moved. We are now living together in El Paso, Texas, West Texas, and been getting settled into our new place out here, got the gym set up, settling into the house, and I started kind of in what's known as in processing, getting myself back into the hospital system that I'll be working and teaching in out here.
What do you think in processing, I mean, obviously I didn't move hospitals outside of like from med school to residency, like, and you're at that point you're getting all your badges, you're, you know, making sure all of your papers are up to date, and then you're learning their EMR. As an attending, and especially somebody who's going to deal with residents, do you have to do like in processing for the hospital and then also the academic system as well?
The most of it is for the hospital. There's all sorts of annoyingly long checklists of tasks and people you have to go meet and get your sheet stamped and say, I met with this person, or I agree to this policy, or I understand this rule, or whatever. And then getting set up with the systems, and they have to make sure, obviously, you've adequate security and background check and clearance and clinical privileges and credentials. And like, yes, you're actually a doctor who's like able to do these things to other humans and things like that. So it's a complicated process.
I thought that if you had a blue check mark on Instagram that you, I heard that you could bypass all of that because you're official.
I tried telling him, like, you guys know my deadlift. I feel like I'm going to go here. They didn't buy it. So
I don't know if I told you this. I had like a little shadow ban on Instagram recently for like the last 36 hours, maybe 48. I couldn't DM anybody. Like, I could send voice notes, but I couldn't like respond to DMs. And I think it was just, you know, the big low carb industry reaching out against me for what we said on seed oils.
The seed oil post.
that's the only thing. I mean, I'm just like, guys, I'm actively combating misinformation on the internet. Like, isn't this what you want? Didn't you ask for this?
That CDOL post was really something, wasn't it?
I mean, yeah, I can appreciate that people have opinions on things that they do regularly, like eat food, for example. But the idea that you can come to an informed conclusion without rigorous training in either the field, so in this case, like nutrition, particularly clinically related nutrition, or some sort of heavy science that has a clinical aspect, like medicine, and then a desire on your own to go off and read all this stuff and see how it fits in. I just don't get it. Like, I mean, if somebody asked me a question on like building a rocket, I would just shrug my shoulders and be like, I don't know, bro.
I'm not your guy.
Yeah. The only thing I can do is I don't know. Same thing on investing. Like, I have investments, for example, but I'm not licensed or qualified to give you advice, even though I understand the markets and I understand, you know, how these things work to some extent, but I don't feel competent to be like, yeah, this is how it is. But people have no problem telling us like, nah, that's all BS. I read this one thing on somebody's blog and and you can't even have a discussion either, because people are like, I don't even agree that science is a thing. And you're like,
I feel like we're at an impasse here.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm just like, why are you here then?
Anyway,
all right.
But I think as an aside, this is something else that people might find interesting. But David McCraney, the guy who does the You Are Not So Smart podcast, he just came out with a new book called How Minds Change, I think is the name of it. And I'm working my way through it. I'm not all the way through it yet. But so far, it is excellent. And I think for anybody who engages in conversation with other humans about potentially contentious topics sometimes, that would be a very worthwhile read for you. Now, part of the issue is that, like, when it comes to these kind of conversations, like we're talking about with polyunsaturated fats and things like that, there's on one hand, you might be having tons of, you know, mountains of scientific evidence and stuff like that, that you're trying to bring to the table. But like you said, there's some people who just, that's not the way that they got to their decision. And so using that as the lever is not going to move them away from their position.
Right.
It is much more of a story that is crafted, and you have to get more of the roots of people's motivations for believing something or for arriving at a certain conclusion, which is a much more involved topic, and certainly not one that Instagram threads or Twitter threads or literally anywhere in text form really is conducive to. So,
right. When I see like a big block of text as a response, like at Barbell Medicine block of text, I'm like, oh boy, here we go. Yeah. I don't know. And you know, what's wild is like when people, even if they're trying to bring evidence to the table, invariably they won't cite it. Or if they do cite it, they'll just use the name. And it's like, well, this person likely has published multiple papers. So, you know, just give me a PMID, you know, like if you want me to quote unquote look it up, like just what's the PMID and then we'll get to it. I remember famously Squat U like published, you know, like cited 10 sources for like why asymmetrical training was like, you know, if you had an imbalance or something that was like bad. And then we pulled the sources and we're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Like if we were Red Pen Reviews, he'd get a 0 out of 10 for like the accuracy of the,
or the relevance of the citations to the claims being made.
Yeah. Yes. Anyway, this is not a Squat U related podcast, but here we go. So House of Gains 6.0 is up and running.
Yeah, I mean, I think Lauren and I were trying to think of how many home gyms I've been through at this point. It's either 5 or 6. I think it's number 5 if I had to go through them. But this is probably the best one yet. So I guess that's the direction things should be going in. If I've been working at this for so long.
Any new additions to the gym? People at home might be interested to know if you're going to like buy anything new, something cool that you've always wanted now that you're somewhere presumably more permanent.
Yeah. I think we'll probably be here for a little while at least. In terms of new equipment, really, I'm not thinking of a ton of stuff. I had debated back and forth a little bit about getting like a competition style combo rack, but at the same time, those are like fairly inconvenient to move around if you want to. And one of my platforms, I just have a set of squat stands on, which are actually super easy to move on and off. So that, like, you know, if Lauren wants to do some weightlifting or anything like that, it's easy to use that platform for it. But and I also don't, like, people are asking me still all the time when I'm going to do a meet. And I'm like, I don't really care about powerlifting competition still, maybe one day, but not enough to get a combo rack. So if anything, I'm actually might be having paring things down a little bit. Like I might be getting rid of my chains and a couple other things that I'm like, I don't really use these or feel like I benefit from them. Pair things back down to the toys that I use most often. But it's nice having all my stuff in one place though, for sure.
Yeah. I think if I had to do it, like if I had a space, let's call it a 3-car garage. Cause it realistically, like I need the spot for the garage, for the car. I need a spot for the dirt bike and tools and whatever. And so then I have like a 1-car garage or maybe a little bit bigger for a training space. I'd get a Rogue R3 rack, the 24-inch one, because that's everything I'd want to do with a rack I could do in there. I'd probably get some squat stands in case I wanted to do, you know, any overhead work that I couldn't do in the rack, for example, or like Bulgarian split squats or, you know, step up something where I could just take a bar out of the rack. You know, that would be interesting. And then I would get a trap bar. I'd have a straight bar. I'd have a safety squat bar. I'd have a training bar in case somebody came over, you know, and I needed to use that or I needed to use it for rehab purposes. I'd have a full complement of weights, both calibrated steels and probably bumpers just in case. And I think the only toys that I would like have outside of conditioning equipment, which I would probably get the assault bike and a rower. I have a ski erg here that I use it infrequently, but it was like a impulse buy because I was like, I just want to do something hard, my upper body. I would probably get a sled. And then the only like two toys that I would want personally would be like a belt squat and maybe like a GHD just because I like those. I figured you wouldn't like the GHD, but I did think you'd be like belt squat curious.
Yeah, I think just not curious enough to commit the floor space to something like that. So right now I just have the two platforms, one R3 rack, a set of squat stands, and then weights and bars and a Rogue air bike. But that's right.
Would you rather have a full complement of dumbbells, fives to, let's just call it 120s, let's just say, and let's just say those were the same exact price as a belt squat, which they're not, but let's just say, would you rather have a belt squat or the dumbbell set?
Probably the dumbbell set, honestly.
Yeah, I thought you would say. I would also probably get I would get like an adjustable bench and then like a regular bench.
Yeah.
But I think the dumbbell thing would be interesting. It's just, gosh, that's a lot of floor space. And that's a lot of like,
exactly.
I feel like you get a notice from like the environmental agency. They're like, hey dude, your carbon footprint is now huge because you just bought all of these rubberized weights. But anyway, maybe in the future, we're going to plug the app again, new app. Is continuously being updated. It is available for free in the Apple iTunes store. Right now we're working on the web app so people with all types of internets and smartphones and whatever can go to our website, use the templates, get coaching, access our resources a little more easily. And then the Android app will be after that. People keep asking, well, any update on that? I'm like, guys, like as soon as it's ready for beta, I know where I'm going.
We're not going to keep it a secret.
Yeah, 100%. But yeah, it's available for free. It's on the Apple App Store right now. If you're curious about any of our programming, how we would recommend you select a template, it's all built in. It's for free. You can access all the first weeks for free. You can use the algorithm that we built to select a template. You can access all of our articles, everything else on the app. So check that out. And then last but not least, hey, we got some new drip. This is going to go up, I think, Wednesday the 20th. And so then on the 22nd, that's how the Gregorian calendar works. 2 days later on Friday, the new gear should be in the Barbell Medicine store online. This one, you can't see it. And listeners, you can't see it because, you know, radio waves, that's how this works. This one has the owl on the back. And, it's funny. I was talking to the graphic designer and I was like, hey, you know the owl from the Tootsie Pop commercial, like, let's do that guy, but jacked. And he comes out with this super jacked, admittedly with a low, you know, small legs, which I mean, I guess owls do have small, tiny little legs. But yeah, Tootsie Pop guy asking, how many more sets do you have left? And I think that's hilarious. We also have some tanks, for men and women. And, so if you're interested in some new Barbell Medicine apparel, it is dropping this Friday, as always, limited quantities, so get yours. And if you were wondering, this model, I feel like I'm a standardized patient, this model, and we use that term very charitably around here, I wear a large. I am 205 to 210 pounds on any given day, more towards the lighter end now. I actually have crept into the high 190s on some days, and I was like, oh, what's happening? I'm small again. But yeah, I wear a large. And that's it. And I feel like I have an above average sized upper body. Somebody commented in your DMs like, you and Jordan are only a few pounds apart, yet carry way more muscle than I do. Am I doing something wrong? And it's like, I mean, we've been doing this for like almost 15 years now.
Yeah.
And I would say with favorable genetics.
Sure.
And favorable programming and, you know, all sorts of stuff. And I don't just mean genetics with response to the programming, but also like the desire to like want to do this stuff. So, yeah, I mean, if you're wearing an XL, that's cool too. But I wear a large. Are you a large or you're medium?
Yeah, I typically wear large shirts.
Sure.
They're probably not as snug on me as they are on you because I've definitely been running lighter than you have been for a while by a few pounds, I guess.
Well, I've been doing all this conditioning and motocross. I'm telling you, man, I'm like, man, am I going to get back to the medium large horizon? Yeah. Like where I'm like, I don't know if I get back into medium, that's gonna be weird. I have a shirt. I'm not going to name the manufacturer because they're not giving me any money for this, but they sent me a shirt, some shirts, and they asked me what size I was. And I said XL at the time. I was like 210. I was like, I'm an extra large. And I put that thing on. I thought it was a compression shirt. I thought it was like the under, like it was suctioned to me. And I said, hey, man, this thing's too small. They're like, oh, yeah, you're probably a double X. And so I put on, they sent me some double X's and I was walking around like I'm, you know, imaginary lat syndrome, the whole thing. I'm double XL now. I went to Nordstrom. I was buying some more clothes. I needed a button up for this event. And I was like, oh, excuse me, can you bring me a double X? I put on a normal sized double X, not this, you know, schmedium small boy double X. And I've never been in a larger shirt. I don't know. Like it was a dress. So I've never quite made it to double X. But yeah, if you're wondering home what sizes we wear large. And the internet will probably take that and run with it. Maybe make a, there'll probably be a meme. I can feel it coming. Any other announcements you can think of?
None that I can think of right now.
We're going to LA. We got a seminar. We got a live in-person seminar. That's in November. So if you want to come to our health and performance seminar, it's 2 days. Austin and I will be there. I think the rest of the crew is going to come in because we haven't done this in a while. So it should be a good time.
And Derek's going to be there. I know that Derek, too, for any rehab-oriented people.
Yep. Derek will be there. And then next year, we're finalizing our locations. Looks like we're going to be on the East Coast a little bit. Maybe Atlanta, New York looks pretty good. Maybe a place in Texas. And then I think also in Seattle at some point. We'll see. So TBD on those. But the one for Los Angeles in November is up and available. And spots are going pretty quick. So if you're interested in joining us, well, come on out. Okay. This is podcast episode 184. We were going to address two, what I would consider very important topics. One is protein restriction for chronic kidney disease, and the other is predictors of weight regain. So we're going to start out with chronic kidney disease and protein restriction. This is a tale as old as, I mean, it's certainly older than the internet. Like this controversy, this tale probably dates back to the 1920s. The idea that if you were at risk of chronic kidney disease, if you had some kidney disease, or even if you wanted to preserve your kidneys, right, for kidney health, quote unquote, kidney health, low protein diet, bro, that's what you need. But let's examine some of the evidence. So this is from the American Society of Nephrology. This came out in June of 2022. So this year, the title is Protein Restriction for CKD, Time to Move On. I've linked that in the description below. It's open access. You guys can check it out. This is from three prominent nephrologists. One, the lead author is Obaid. But our favorite nephrologist is on the paper, Joel Toff, Kidney Boy. And if you are looking for people to follow on Twitter who post interesting information, at Kidney Boy, Joel Toff. Do you have his text? His like?
Yes, I do.
It's for management of chronic kidney disease, or is it just like called the kidney, the nephron?
Oh, no. I think he has a few different texts that he's been involved in. The one that I have has to do with kind of critical care nephrology, basically like dealing with kidney problems in like very, very sick people, like the kind that I will deal with in the hospital. But I know he's been involved in several other things. He wrote way back a text that I think that's freely available called like the acid base and electrolyte companion.
Yeah, that's the one I
read way back, and to learn the basics of nephrology, basically, which is a really good introductory one for people who are as big of nerds as we are.
I remember reading that. I'm like, damn, chloride, why are you so complicated? my favorite part of this entire article is actually the very first line. It starts with this quote. It says all a low protein diet does is to shrink the patient down to the size of his kidneys. And that's from Frank Parsons. This is a UK trained physician. He was a pioneer of dialysis and kidney transplantation. He's from the UK. So in any case, this is a review of the evidence for the dietary management of chronic kidney disease, specifically dietary protein restriction. Because again, you always hear, look, if you're at any risk of kidney disease or you have kidney disease, eat a low protein diet. And there's been a lot of controversy about this. And I think when we review some of the evidence, you'll see why it's been so controversial. So first, Austin, before we talk about, you know, what the current recommendations are for protein and dietary protein intake and chronic kidney disease, can we give the listeners at home an overview of like what actually is chronic kidney disease?
Sure. So this will be a very summarized, I guess, superficial overview because this is a complicated topic. But I mean, a lot of folks who are health oriented, you know, who maybe are maybe listening, probably understand that the kidneys serve as most simplistically as sort of like blood filters. They help us excrete toxins. They also do a lot of other things beyond that, but they are the things that produce urine, and the production of urine is the byproduct of their ability to kind of maintain homeostasis, maintain normal blood levels of all sorts of important things like your sodium and your potassium and things like that. They also regulate things like your pH, the acid-base balance in your blood. They're involved in regulating blood pressure. They're involved in other hormone-related processes like making enough blood and all sorts of things. So very, very, very important organs. Most people, I would argue, take them for for granted, but that's kind of like an overview of their role. And so when the kidneys become injured in some way, particularly for in a way that is persistent over time. So chronic kidney disease is defined by having kidney damage or decreased kidney function for 3 or more months. And this can happen for many, many, many different causes. There are way, you know, the massive list of reasons why people can develop chronic kidney disease. Among the most common that we see, you know, say in the U.S. these days is poorly controlled diabetes that can exist for long periods of time, and that can lead to damage, structural damage to the kidney, and that can also contribute to decreases in kidney function. And when I say decreases in kidney function, that's something that is, it can refer to many different things because, again, the kidney has many different functions, but most objectively and commonly measured is this concept called a filtration rate. So basically, I mentioned that they act as blood filters. And so we're measuring how quickly, what's the rate that they are filtering your blood and thereby producing urine. And we use a bunch of, you know, blood tests that we can use to do this and equations that we can use to estimate how quickly or if in the setting of chronic kidney disease, how slowly somebody's kidneys are filtering the blood. And as chronic kidney disease progresses, if it worsens to the point where the kidneys are filtering less and less and less blood, making less and less and less urine, doing their all of those jobs more poorly, then you can get, you know, those electrolytes that I mentioned can get really out of whack. Your blood pressure can get really out of whack. You can stop making enough blood for yourself and become anemic. And all of these kind of things are what we see in patients who require dialysis in the long term. So that's kind of like an overview of what the kidneys do for us. What is the definition of chronic kidney disease, that kidney damage or decreased kidney function? And it has to be for at least 3 months or longer persistent because we have fluctuations in our kidney function on shorter term basis all the time. So that's kind of like an overview of that particular topic.
Yeah. And for the clinicians that are listening to this, they're like, bro, you didn't even mention glomerular filtration rate once. You didn't mention specific cutoffs for stage one, stage two, stage three, stage four, stage five. And it's like, well, yeah, those things exist, but that doesn't really change the overarching definition, the umbrella term that is chronic kidney disease. And then if you are a clinician listening to this and you know about the different stages, hey, congratulations. That's good. You can go look them up. Like, you know, but for people listening to this, yeah, I think that was an excellent summary of like, what is chronic kidney disease? You might also hear this referred to as CKD. And at its later or latter stages, ESKD as for end stage kidney disease. But yeah, I think that was good. So the current recommendations from the Kidney Disease Quality Outcomes Initiative state that in adults with chronic kidney disease, stages 3 to 5, so those are later stages, who are otherwise metabolically stable, so those folks, you know, tend to be living, you know, in the community by themselves, their diabetes, if they have it, for example, is well managed, they recommend protein restriction to reduce risk for end-stage kidney disease and improve quality of life. So the idea here is that if you take in less dietary protein, you will either slow the progression of kidney disease, so you don't progress from stage 3 to stage 4 to stage 5 rapidly. That's claim one. And then claim two, that it also improves quality of life, which is harder to define, although there are a bunch of validated metrics that can be used. But in any case, that is the claim, and that is where they come up with these recommendations, which are to follow either a low or very low protein diet. And how this shakes out really just depends on the patient and their current dietary protein intake. But the low protein recommendations are to take in from 0.55 to 0.6 grams of protein per kilogram body weight, or 0.28 to 0.43 grams of protein per kilogram body weight. That's the very low protein recommendation. And if you compare and contrast that to the current dietary guidelines for Americans, right, or what some people would call the RDA, recommended daily allowance, that's 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day. So significantly lower than the current recommendations, which, by the way, I've heard this, I've seen this. People say, oh, we're not eating enough protein. And I'm like, the average protein intake, particularly in the United States, is relatively high. Most people are well above that 0.8 grams per kilogram per day. Do we think that's optimal, particularly from like a muscle mass function and muscle mass amount? Absolutely not. But as far as like, are people routinely eating less protein than they need per day? Answer to that, no. Usually much higher. The quality of that protein tends to be relatively low because it's from processed red meats, for example, or other foods where they're not getting the full complement of essential amino acids, but that's for another podcast. The whole point, though, when people say, oh, you're not eating, most people don't eat enough protein per day, it's like citation or like caveat. Because if what you mean, like, it's not enough for muscle optimal muscle mass function and amount, sure, we agree.
That's a different claim, yeah.
Yeah, different claim. Okay, so in any case, let's get to the science. Does dietary protein increase pre-existing kidney disease? So if you take the Wayback Machine, which I think you're too young to get that cartoon reference, the Wayback Machine, Mr. Peabody, Rocky Bullwinkle. Okay. Back in the 1920s, if we go back there, there were a few animal models that showed this thing called hyperfiltration. Basically means there's a ton of blood flow going into the glomerulus, which is where the kidney does its dirty work, filters the blood. It's this tuft, if you will, of arteries and veins and these semi-permeable sort of membranes. And in any case, when you dump a bunch of blood in there, you can get above normal levels of filtration, aka hyperfiltration. And this can cause a bunch of things depending on how you get to that point. Increased glomerular filtration rate, which you might think, hey, that's good. If that's a marker of quote unquote kidney health, why is raising that bad? Well, that seems to be temporary. And then it tends to go below normal if that persists. So one of the disease processes that does this, for example, is high blood pressure. High blood pressure causes hyperfiltration as it starts out. And then if you keep slamming the kidney with all this blood, they tend to get damaged. So the glomerular sclerosis, for example, would be one of the pathologies that you see. And so you get things like protein in the urine, that's called proteinuria, et cetera. This, again, was seen in the 1920s in animal models. So already we're thinking, ooh, dietary protein may be not so great for quote unquote kidney health. The mechanism at play here is that dietary protein raises nitric oxide levels, and that increases the diameter of the artery leading to the glomerulus. So if you dilate that, make it bigger, the blood flow there increases. And so you get this rush of blood going in there. High blood pressure doesn't really dilate that artery, doesn't make it any bigger, but it does increase the pressure by which that glomerulus is getting slammed by blood. Interestingly, it is presumed that a low protein diet actually causes vasoconstriction, a narrowing of that artery leading to the glomerulus, which is supposed to reduce the filtration rate back to quote unquote normal. That's actually the same mechanism of action as the SGLT2 inhibitors, the sodium glucose co-transporter 2. And we use those drugs all the time. I say we, like the royal we. I don't prescribe these, the Flozins, but you see people on those drugs, those medications all the time. So what are they used
for? Yeah, I prescribe those medicines and use them regularly. I would say probably a fair number of our listeners may be on them. They're medicines that have probably come up when we've talked about diabetes and weight loss before too. So these medicines are relatively newer in the diabetes world, which is kind of where they were first studied, although
we're finding that they have benefits in tons of other areas. And so they're now becoming like also cardiovascular medicines and kidney medicines and being used for all sorts of things because we're seeing randomized controlled trial evidence of benefit in all sorts of different areas. And this most simplistic way to think about these medicines is that they block the ability of our kidneys to reabsorb any sugar, glucose, that gets filtered into the urine. So if any glucose gets into past the glomerulus, if it gets filtered, our kidneys normally reabsorb it, suck it back up, because probably from an evolutionary standpoint, it was very valuable to not lose any last molecule of glucose that you could. These medicines block our ability to do that. So people end up effectively peeing out extra glucose, and you'll pee out a set number of calories per day effectively. And so these tend to generate a little bit of weight loss. Tend to facilitate a little bit more, have a bit of a diuretic effect, so tend to lower blood pressure a little bit. But those are the most simplistic ways that we understood the medicine to work very early on. However, since then, we have found all sorts of other interesting effects, which, well, interesting to probably me and you, beyond the scope of what we could get into in this podcast, in terms of altering things like sodium handling in the kidney, altering some of these blood pressures in various parts of the kidney, altering the way the heart utilizes things for energy, and a bunch of other things that we've discovered that have led to better outcomes in cardiovascular disease, led to better outcomes in kidney disease, and led to better outcomes in diabetes as well. So these are being used very, very commonly. I use them all the time in most of the patients that I see that have these kinds of issues.
Yeah. I think the take-home point is that while the mechanism may be similar, or at least part of the mechanism may be similar in that it reduces, you know, the size of the artery leading to the glomerulus, therefore decreasing filtration, going back to normal, the way that you get there is important. So if you do it via a low protein diet, that seems to be due mostly to a decrease in nitric oxide, which is its own sort of enzyme with a bunch of other activities. And that subsequently has a myriad of different effects. And if you do it via a medication, it's got its own myriad of effects. And this is most analogous, you know, to kind of understand this, that it depends how you get there, probably to blood pressure and you know, what high blood pressure does from having high resting blood pressure, so hypertension, versus having elevated blood pressure during activity, you know, which we see in every physical activity. You cannot perform a, you know, physical activity without your blood pressure going up. That is part of the normal adaptive response. And so if you have high resting blood pressure, high, you know, hypertension, yeah, you can get arteriosclerosis. You can, you know, be at risk of a greater risk of heart disease. Whereas if you exercise, even though you're still experiencing these transient increases in blood pressure, you actually have a reduction in heart disease, a reduction in resting blood pressure. So it matters how you get there. So the idea that like, oh, a low protein diet works as an SGLT2 inhibitor, it's like, I think that's a stretch. And to be clear, no one's really claiming that, but that is like one of the purported mechanisms. And we're like, probably matters how you get there. You agree with that?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And ultimately, this is why we... Again, it's like one of our pet topics that we keep coming back to, but rather than focusing on mechanism, looking at actual outcomes, right? Because you can hypothesize that, oh, anything else that shares this mechanism is going to have the same effect. But then if you study it and the actual outcomes that you see in actual people with this actual condition doing this actual intervention, if they don't point in the same direction or if they point in opposite directions, then you have to reconsider, is it due to the mechanism that you thought it was, or is something else at play that you maybe don't know about yet?
Yeah, exactly. So people, when we say, oh yeah, sometimes your logic fails, right? It doesn't get you where you think it should go. But the reality is you just don't know all of the players. You don't know enough to actually form the logical sort of argument. Okay. So what does the science say? Now, most of this data is from the 90s and early 2000s. The first trial that's kind of cited in this paper and that as a sort of strong source of evidence for reducing dietary protein, they took 450 patients. Who had diagnosed kidney disease, and they randomized them to a low protein diet where they were getting 0.6 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day, or normal protein, which is actually higher, 1 gram of protein per kilogram body weight per day. So actually not just like they were eating the RDA, but like a substantial amount more. Now, interestingly, none of them could be on ACE inhibitors, which is a common medication used, particularly a few years later, in patients with kidney disease, but they couldn't be on that in this particular study. The difference as far as like progression of kidney disease did not reach significance. And interestingly, 14% of the subjects withdrew from the study 14% of those who were in the low protein diet withdrew from the study because it was too hard for them to stick on to stay with the diet. Interestingly, the kidney function loss, as far as it could be measured at the time, was actually greater in the low protein group. So it's like even those who stayed with it, they didn't really see a benefit. And it's like, this is supposed to be used in support of a low protein diet? Question mark. Another study, and there are some problems with this study. They didn't pre-specify any outcomes. No individual data on individual patients were available or reported. But after a four-year follow-up where one group got low protein and another group got normal protein, the authors stated, after 4 years of follow-up, we are only moderately optimistic about dietary protein restriction as a general measure for the management of the progression of chronic renal insufficiency, which is a fancy way of saying, we don't really know if this protein restriction is going to do jack for people with kidney disease. Two other studies were actually also reviewed in this this paper that we're talking about here, and neither of them found robust evidence for low protein diets lowering the risk of kidney disease or slowing the progression of kidney disease. So like kind of a double whammy there. As recently as 2020, the Cochrane systematic the Cochrane group did a systematic review, and the Cochrane group, we like them in general because they're independent. They kind of sort through all of the data and make it available for clinicians and people interested in this stuff. So we tend to value their data pretty highly. So this systematic review they did in 2020 showed no effect of a low protein diet versus a normal protein diet on glomerular filtration rate and how quickly that declined. So, you know, that basically that would be a marker of the progression of chronic kidney disease. So far we're over four. We got four studies reviewed, one systematic review, some with a pretty long outcome, follow-up 4 years, not really in support, certainly not a robust amount of evidence showing, man, low protein diet's really doing the trick here on chronic kidney disease. There, one of the more famous studies, though, this modification of diet in renal disease, the famous MDRD study, showed that a low protein diet reduces the symptoms of uremia, which Austin, I'll have you talk about that. This is something that people who get chronic kidney disease, they get these symptoms of uremia. And so that would be like a trigger for a clinician to start considering dialysis, which is basically like a machine doing the jobs of your kidney. So in that study, basically, if these folks followed a low protein diet and they had a delay in progression to symptoms of uremia, perhaps you could delay the initiation of dialysis. So maybe that study would have a signal supporting a low protein diet as folks got closer and closer to needing dialysis. The interesting point of this, and we'll get back to uremia here in a second, is that when this study has been reanalyzed, and it has been reanalyzed to death, the actual source of the protein, not the amount of protein, seems to be an even stronger signal. So that means that people who are eating a high, their protein intake, if it came from a high amount of red meat, especially processed red meat, that tended to increase the risk of having symptoms of uremia, whereas the amount, if they had a higher amount of fish, eggs, dairy, or poultry, that did not seem to correlate well with symptoms of uremia. So at that point, you're wondering, is it the dose or is it the source? And, you know, I'm certainly not a statistician, and I know that there are a lot of primary studies here, and I don't pretend to have read all of them. But I think that if you're looking for very robust evidence showing that lowering the dietary protein amount, and only the amount, as a potential intervention for reducing risk of developing chronic kidney disease or reducing the progression rate, I'm kind of left scratching my head. I'm like, what the heck's going on here? Austin, what is uremia, and what kind of symptoms are people experiencing? That what does that even mean?
Yeah, so since I described the kidneys as kind of functioning in part as blood filters and helping us excrete a lot of metabolic byproducts and toxins and things like that, as kidney disease advances and that filtration rate declines, sometimes to very, very low levels, these things will start to accumulate, and they can have consequences, including a variety of symptoms. And uremia is a very broad general term, but sometimes patients can get, you know, pretty fatigued. There can be some itching. There can be some nausea. There can be some cognitive effects, things like that. There's a bunch of other ones. It's a lengthy list. But the interesting thing here, and this is pointed out by the authors of this paper that was just published that we're kind of drawing this research review from, is that uremia in general, the symptoms that come out from chronic kidney disease, like it takes a surprisingly long time. And by long time, I mean, rather, I should say, a surprisingly large decline in kidney function before people develop these kind of symptoms. Like, your kidneys have to be very, very bad before these things start to crop up, and before somebody will actually say it's time to actually start dialysis on you. And this is this is illustrated commonly. Like, we'll look at, oh, what's a completely normal like GFR for somebody? It could be like 125, and that there's some units associated with that that people don't need to worry about right now. And then we have these stages of chronic kidney disease as you start to get below 90 and 60 and 30 and 15, and it's like all the way down, sub 15, we're having some of these conversations. And so it takes, again, a very long time. And so the authors of this paper that we're reviewing here, that we're talking about, they point out that in this study that they didn't really show that the low protein diet had a significant effect on how quickly GFR decreased. In other words, it didn't seem to have a big effect on like the rate of decline of filtration, but it did maybe prevent some of the symptoms. And perhaps it's that delay of symptoms where people didn't feel bad enough to where doctors then delayed the initiation of dialysis. And so it's like, if that's the case, if it really can mitigate some of these symptoms, but doesn't really seem to have a very clear effect on reducing the rate of decline in infiltration, then is it even appropriate to be recommending this to people even with earlier degrees or milder degrees of kidney impairment, chronic kidney disease? Or should it just be, if it does have this benefit of reducing symptoms, then just wait until people are at that more advanced stage to say, hey, this is something that might make you feel better, right? But not necessarily recommend it the entire time to mitigate the rate of decline if we don't have awesome evidence that it actually does that.
Yeah. It's like in sarcopenia, right? Like, you have to lose so much muscle mass before you get the decline in function that's actually like noticeable, like frankly noticeable. But imagine you had a medication that like almost artificially restored somebody's muscle function. It's like, wait, now we're delaying all of these potential good interventions further? Like, wait, what? That doesn't make any sense. Yeah. I don't know. Probably the most important thing I took away from this paper, though, is that all of this data was done before we had any medications that targeted the renin-angiotensin system. Like, we have multiple medications now that can block that system that are heavily involved in treating chronic kidney disease at various stages. So it may in fact have been that a low protein diet was like one of the better things that we could have done at the time based on our knowledge, based on the environment, based on the medications we had available to us. Although, again, this data doesn't seem to reflect that, but let's just say, but now we have all these additional medications that just changes the landscape of where you're interpreting these papers from. It's like, all right, cool. We reduced protein, but it really didn't do anything. Maybe it did a little bit towards the end stage, but we have all these other medications. Like, where's that data now? And it's like, man, I don't really know what to do with this old historical data. It's kind of irrelevant at this point because nobody would come into the clinic being managed for chronic kidney disease without being on one of these medications. So, like, Austin, what is that physiological system and what do those medications do?
Yeah, so a nephrologist might get picky and tell you that it's pronounced renin, but that's just the way they are. But renin-angiotensin-aldosterone is this this complement of hormones that kind of act in concert to orchestrate a whole bunch of really important things, including blood pressure, electrolyte balance, tightness of our blood vessels, and then that has downstream impacts or potentially upstream impacts on things like our heart and kidney function as well. So this is a extremely important system. I end up basically having to, in some way, deal with, interact, or manipulate this hormone system in patients multiple times a day, every day in practice. So very, very common, very, very important. And we have evidence that medications that block certain aspects of this system, common ones were actually outlined in our blood pressure podcast and in the blood pressure article that I wrote. So anybody who's on an ACE inhibitor, like lisinopril, for example, that's one inhibitor of this pathway. Other medicines like spironolactone is another example of something that kind of acts in generally on this whole pathway. And there are several others as well. But these are very commonly used medicines, and they have evidence for reducing some of that protein leak, proteinuria that you talked about through the glomerulus when it gets injured in chronic kidney disease, reducing that hyperfiltration, reducing that high blood pressure within the glomerulus, within the filtration site itself, and a bunch of other potential mechanisms by which they can reduce the rate of decline of kidney function in patients with chronic kidney disease and improve outcomes markedly. And this extends also to patients with heart issues and a bunch of other conditions as well. So really important system. We manipulate it all the time. And blocking it using one or more of these medicines in certain situations, we have randomized controlled trial level evidence that it improves outcomes for patients. So that's why we use it all the time. And so, you know, it's an interesting point that you make that if a lot of that data came from an era before these medicines that seem to have much more clear and apparent benefits, then it's difficult to just assume or extrapolate any potential small benefits from back then and say, oh, that's probably just going to stack on top of, be additive to any benefits we get from these medicines. It may just be obliterated by the benefits that we get from the medicines. And then you don't necessarily get as much or any of those benefits from that low protein diet intervention while you do get all the harms and downsides, which is kind of a big deal.
Could I tell you one of the most embarrassing moments of my life?
If you're willing to put that out there, go for it, man.
I was doing – so during my master's in anatomy and clinical physiology, I was doing a presentation on the kidneys in the anatomy lab. And I was talking, of course, about the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system and, you know, how it relates and whatever. But I don't know why, it just happened again. But yeah, you bet your butt I said renin. I did. And I – look, renin – And I was called out by my anatomy, one of the anatomy professors. And she goes, what did you say? And I said, renin. And she goes, what? And I said it again. And I get a third time. She says, excuse me, one more time. And I said, renin. I was kind of angry at that point. And she goes, that is an enzyme that's used to curdle milk in cows' stomachs and make cheese. Renin is the enzyme that you're referring to. I'm like, I'm going to go kill myself, guys. I'm out of here. It's like, I can't. So very, yes, well explained. And thank you for the correction. That is important because I don't want anybody to go to the bar, try to impress somebody and they say renin. And then that professor somehow is there. And then you have my experience. So say renin, don't say renin. Unless you are, in fact, talking about the enzyme with two N's in cow stomachs that help milk curdle. Okay. I think you summarized it nicely. You know, with this new data, it's really hard to take these findings and be like, yep, that checks out. That makes sense. We should do a low protein diet. And further, none of these recommendations seem to be weighed with the consideration for how important lean body mass is, particularly for longevity, living an independent and high quality life. And how protein intake influences that. If somebody's on one of these low protein or very low protein diets, we have what I would consider to be very strong evidence that their lean body mass is going to decrease, and a reduction in lean body mass, particularly as you age, is straight up not a good time and, you know, portends bad outcomes. So I think if you're like comparing risk benefit, I could feel very confident in saying, eating a protein, a dietary protein amount that supports lean body mass function and lean body mass amount, the benefits of that, based on the current evidence, outweigh the purported benefits of a low protein diet in chronic kidney disease, particularly early stage chronic kidney disease. I don't really know, you know, when patients have uremia, like at that point, what you're doing, if you're considering dialysis, maybe that calculus changes. But even then I'm like, man, these signals just don't seem that strong. So like, what are we doing here?
And in patients, and assuming patients are being adequately treated from a medication standpoint, if they're on the right meds, would be the other criterion for this kind of a position. Ultimately, it's going to end up being an individual conversation with patients between the patient and the clinician. But again, I don't know how many clinicians are keeping as up on this thing and are comfortable having this kind of a conversation. The other caveat I would add is like when it comes to the amount of dietary protein, I think you made a good point earlier about emphasizing the source as well, because we're talking about an overall dietary pattern here. And additionally, we don't need to be purely kidney centric here. Like, most common reason these people die is still cardiovascular disease. And so we should be still recommending not only the right amount of protein, but the sources will matter, not only potentially for their kidney related health, but also cardiovascular health, and all the other reasons why we typically recommend people go towards certain protein sources and maybe perhaps away from others. Maybe some of the leaner, if people are going to include animal sources, the leaner types, perhaps a little bit less on the red meat side, a little bit more on the fish side, and then plant protein is all good. When we've talked about things like legumes and things like that, we're all good to go. So those would be some of the added considerations I'd be having in these discussions with people.
How many nephrologists do you think are listening to this? And they're like, shirts off. Let's go. I'm going to take the barbell medicine crew on.
I mean, I know at least like one or two, but
we'll deadlift to the death. No, I mean, I think even conservatively, you could say we need better data on protein restricted diets in this particular population. And if you wanted to be more aggressive and say, you know, we shouldn't even pay any attention to this at all, I would say, well, you could make that argument based on the evidence, particularly in the current landscape. But, you know, it's like you said, it's going to be individualized. I think more importantly, and particularly for our listenership, when we're talking about protein intake and like the risk of developing chronic kidney disease, I feel very comfortable in saying like, I don't see the connection. I see the connection between maybe a poor dietary pattern that results in quote unquote high levels of dietary protein, but I don't know that it's the protein. I think in fact that it is the dietary pattern, because most people who eat a high protein diet who are not involved in the fitness scene at all and are eating a ton, you know, a high amount of protein are eating a lot of red meat and particularly processed red meat and other sources of protein that are coming with added sugars, high levels of sodium, high levels of saturated fat, et cetera.
Yeah, they're probably eating just a high calorie diet.
Yes, exactly. Yes, exactly. So if you have a health promoting dietary pattern and you're eating the dietary protein amount that we recommend, which is at 1.4 to 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day, and you're getting that from poultry, fish, dairy, you know, plant sources, et cetera, I do not think that that is going to alter your risk for developing chronic kidney disease compared to eating a lower protein diet from those same sources.
Agree.
Hey, we agree. Look at that. You know, that was only supposed to be like 20 minutes. We just doubled that. I don't know how much of that was our happy talk at the beginning, but
yeah, well, I can get through this next one probably quicker.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Paper number two, the association between fat-free mass loss after diet and exercise interventions and weight regain in women with overweight and obesity. So this is from the Medicine and Science and Sports and Exercise Journal, published ahead of print. It's from July, so from this month of this year, 2022. This is from the University of Alabama, Martins et al. Linked that in the description below. So the background here is that fat-free mass plays a role in the drive to eat. And so this paper is looking at, does fat-free mass loss during a dietary and or exercise intervention alter the amount of weight regain based on this premise? So again, the alteration of fat-free mass amount. So if you lose muscle mass, that's fat-free mass. It's mass that does not have any fat on it. Does it influence the risk of weight regain? So before we get into this, Austin, can you talk about what influences the drive to eat and eating behavior and maybe how this changes as somebody's weight changes?
Yeah, this is kind of like the intro question last time, an absolutely massive topic that could expound upon for many hours. But ultimately, you know, we all experience this drive to eat. And this is influenced by tons of different factors that are ultimately integrated and kind of executed by the brain for the most part. And so this includes various biological factors, psychological factors, social environmental factors that are all kind of, as I said, integrated and drive the ultimate behavioral pattern that we see. So people who've been listening to our stuff are unsurprised to hear us talk about a kind of a biopsychosocial perspective on this particular phenomenon. But we like to conceptualize eating behavior as being driven by, at least in an oversimplified way, kind of a balance between appetite and satiety. And appetite itself is pretty complicated because there are different dimensions to it. Appetite, this kind of drive to eat and to initiate a meal, there are different varieties of hunger that we can experience that contribute to our appetite. For example, there's this concept of homeostatic hunger, which basically just describes the hunger that arises due to our actual physiological need for calories, for example. And that can be contrasted with hedonic hunger. Hedonic hunger is kind of more of a drive to eat for pleasure. That's more independent of our actual need for calories. And all of these things are in turn, you know, influenced by, again, who's around us, what's around us, the food that's in front of us, the sensory characteristics of the meal,
various other things in our environment, as well as our own personal psychology, our history with that food. Did we grow up with it? Is it a comfort food for us? All sorts of other things. Stress, sleep can impact appetite and our drive to eat, and how many calories we end up consuming before we terminate a meal. And then and then various biological factors, principally genetics, but many other factors. So ultimately, eating behavior is a real complicated emergent phenomenon that I would say we still probably don't even fully grasp, influenced by lots of different variables. And so we do know, though, that it changes as weight changes, and different people will have these kind of responses to different degrees. And to some extent, that's probably influenced by genetics, such that, for example, as some people lose weight, be it a combination of body fat and lean body mass, as they lose weight, they may have marked increases in appetite to try to kind of compensate and restore that weight that they have lost back towards their previous level. Whereas other people may be kind of genetically wired up or behaviorally end up acting in a way that does not necessarily lead to that same degree of a kind of a feedback that leads them to swing back up towards the prior weight. And that's just, you know, one example of all the different ways that people can vary, all the different individual level variation. Other things, for example, that can change is, like, you know, if somebody is to actually overfeed and gain weight as a result of consuming excess calories, some people will spontaneously really ramp up their physical activity and how much energy expenditure they have, just not consciously. They just start moving more, doing all sorts of things, and that will act to, again, restore things back down towards where they were before. Whereas other people will have little to no effect from that, and so the weight that they gain will tend to stick around. And again, I wish it was like as simple as saying all of this is within people's conscious control, and they could, you know, some people are just deciding to move more, and some people are deciding to move less, and some people are deciding to eat more, and some people are deciding to eat less. But so much of this is governed by things that are outside of our conscious control, things that we are kind of pre-wired up for and genetically wired up for. And then when you mix that with the environment that we have around us, the kinds of foods that we have around us, the social context, all these other kind of things, then we see how these kind of genetic predispositions manifest in our modern food and social environment.
Man, well said. And I think, you know, if you're like, huh, how is hunger and eating behaviors, how are they regulated? Just go back and re-listen to that and then do it a third time. And then
put it on 0.5 speed or something if you need to.
Yeah. Because it is. It's very complicated. And again, this all assumes that the regulation and the influences are not dynamic and always function the same in each individual. And that is not the case. So effectively, some of this breakdown between appetite, hunger, and satiety, you know, is what's driving the persistence of excess body weight, excess body energy storage. Because what you would want if somebody developed very large stores of excess energy is that their hunger would precipitously drop, so they'd eat less, and their physical activity would precipitously rise, so they would move more, and that would correct for this excess energy, it's higher than normal, higher than healthy storage of body fat. But when that breaks down and that doesn't happen, you get this persistence of adiposity, and you know that's really what's underlying a lot of this obesity epidemic. So in any case, we're going to focus on some of these biological inputs. And in this paper in particular, we're going to talk about the amino-static model. And I know when I say that, because there's so many syllables, people are like, what the heck does that mean? The amino-static model basically is a fancy way of saying that hunger and subsequent energy intake are driven by hormonal signals from the muscle tissue that are interacting with centers in the brain that drive hunger, eating behaviors, and physical activity. The idea is that if you lose a lot of or some amount of lean body mass during either a dietary intervention, so you're trying to lose weight, or starvation, or something like that, the result after like the food environment is restored, if you were in starvation, or the end of a dietary intervention, will be that you would overeat and you'd be very, very hungry. We call that hyperphagia. So this is supported in men by the Minnesota starvation experiment. These people lost incredible amounts of fat-free mass, muscle mass, and they had a very strong desire to eat, a very strong hunger response when they were allowed to eat ad libitum. so as much as they wanted. And that's even when correcting for fat mass loss. So that's the immunostatic model. Also, it should be noted there's a lipostatic model that basically is similar, but it has to do with fat mass. Basically, hormones from the adipose tissue and the GI tract interact with these centers in the brain that have to do with hunger, eating behaviors, physical activity, et cetera, like that. And when you lose a substantial amount of fat mass, those hormonal signals ramp up and cause you to be hungrier and move a little less, or in some cases move a lot less in order to restore fat mass. So the immunostatic model is basically a way to restore lean body mass. So that's protein, amino protein, lean body mass made of protein, not fat. The lipostatic model is a mechanism for restoring fat mass, lipo, you know, standing for lipids. Referring to lipids, and then you're trying to restore fat mass if you have lost that. This is actually kind of the underlying premise behind why a maintenance period is necessary after weight loss. So if you lose some weight, and it's going to be a blend of fat mass and fat-free mass, so you're going to lose some fat, some muscle. If you just like ramped right back up to maintenance level calories without this maintenance period, you would preferentially restore fat mass. And that is thought to be due to this sort of lipostatic model, this sort of preference for restoring fat mass, because the body's like, wait, why did you get rid of all these energy stores? Why you do that? And then it's like, we're just going to preferentially restore these things. And so that kind of runs counter to the bro science, where it's like, yo, you should get as lean as possible, because then afterwards you're going to put on only muscle mass. You're going to be so sensitive to all these dietary inputs and you're going to put on a ton of muscle mass. Well, the reality is you're actually primed and ready to put on a bunch of fat mass, which is why the maintenance period can be useful after a period of weight loss where you lose both a little bit of lean body mass and a little bit of fat mass. And that can be kind of altered based on how much protein you're eating, how much resistance training you're doing, genetics, et cetera. But in any case, that's kind of the premise for having a maintenance period. In any case, their data for this, particularly in men, is relatively strong that a greater loss of fat-free mass during a dietary intervention predicts weight regain. But this study was unique because it focused only on women. And prior to this, we just didn't have data on women. And so, yeah, we could assume that men and women respond similarly. But this study kind of did the groundwork that we needed to say, yeah, in fact, that does happen. So the purpose of the study was to determine if the amount of fat-free mass lost during an intervention, so either diet alone, diet plus aerobic training, or diet plus resistance training, is a predictor of weight regain. What they did is they took 141 women, average BMI was 25, so they were all individuals with overweight or obesity, average age was 35, and all of them were previously sedentary, so insufficiently active, not meeting the current physical activity guidelines. The intervention, this is basically from two separate studies that were retrospectively analyzed, so analyzed after the fact. The first study, they basically looked at individuals on a diet alone. Those folks were eating 800 calories per day for a period of time that was kind of open-ended. But basically, they stopped the intervention once they achieved a BMI of less than 25, so a normal BMI. The second study, they basically compared diet alone again. They did the same study over again, but then they also had two additional arms, diet plus resistance training, lifting weights 3 times a week, or diet plus aerobic training or conditioning 3 times a week. And they basically just looked at not only how long did it take for folks to lose the necessary body weight, but also how fast and how much do they regain in a year-long follow-up afterwards. So in order to evaluate not only how much weight did they gain, but what was the composition of the weight that they regained, if they gained any at all, they did a DEXA scan. They did this after a 4-week stabilization phase after the weight loss, and then they did it again a year later. So what happened? On average, these folks lost about 12 kilograms of body weight, and 11.6 kilograms of this was fat mass, and a half kilo on average was fat-free mass or muscle. Now, to be clear, that's not necessarily all muscle. Could be water, could be organ, could be glycogen stores or whatever. So they may, in fact, have not lost any skeletal muscle.
Yeah, it seems like they did pretty good.
Yeah. It's not like these are exactly like powerlifters or bodybuilders. And there are certainly studies out there where they do DEXA scans and people have gained lean body mass. And we'll get to that in a second. And in any case, so that's the average weight loss after the dietary intervention or after the intervention period, which again, these folks are on 800 calories a day for an open-ended period of time until they got to a BMI less than 25. So that's thing one. On average, they lost about 12 kilos, most of it being fat mass. Now, in the year follow-up, the average weight regain was 6 kilos after a year. So they gained about half of it back, almost all of it fat, but there was a wide range of inter-individual variation. So some people lost even more weight, an additional 3.5 kilos or so, whereas some people gained over 20 kilos back. They gained more than they even started. Huge inter-individual variation. There was also a wide inter-individual variation in the amount of fat-free muscle that they lost. That ranged for people who lost 32.7% of fat-free mass and people who actually gained muscle mass 28.2%. So some people were on the gains train and other people were like, no, I'm going to lose a bunch. So yeah, huge inter-individual variation there. It's exactly what we expect because we know that not everyone's going to respond the same to a given intervention. We've talked about that a bunch. Importantly, the amount of fat-free muscle loss was largest in those who only did the diet. So they did no aerobic training or no resistance training. So on average, people who were doing the diet only lost about 10% of fat-free mass or muscle, whereas people who did the diet plus aerobic training lost about 2% of lean body mass. And people who did diet plus lifting 3 times a week actually gained about 3.5% of fat-free mass. So they, on average, people were gaining some muscle mass, which is good. As expected, based on all the data we had from before, which again was mostly in dudes, the amount of fat-free mass lost, the amount of muscle mass lost was associated with more weight regain. The relationship I would classify as moderate. I'm not super impressed by an R value of 0.2. If it was 0.9, I'd be like, holy crap, this is like a one-to-one almost relationship, but certainly seems to be associated. It was statistically significant. But yeah, it's not like the strongest relationship I've ever seen. But yeah, those with a negative percentage of fat-free muscle loss, which was almost 2/3 of the study group. So those folks lost fat-free mass during the intervention. They regained significantly more weight compared with those who had a positive percentage of fat-free muscle loss. So those who actually gained lean body mass. So yeah, if you lost lean body mass during the intervention, that sets you up for, you know, weight regain, where it seemed like if you gained muscle mass, that sets you up for weight maintenance or at least a lower risk of weight regain. So Austin, before we get into like really analyzing these things, does this inter-individual variation like jump out to you, or is this like kind of what you expected?
This is pretty much is exactly what I would expect with most of these kind of interventions. It's similar to the inter-individual variation that we see when doing almost any intervention on humans that has any degree of efficacy. You know, when we treat people with high blood pressure with the same dose of the same medicine, we see a wide range of how much it comes down. When we put people on our strength training program, we see a wide range of how much muscle mass they gain, how much strength they gain, all the way from nothing to maybe even losing some strength and muscle mass, all the way to freak status kind of gains. And so we're seeing similar things here. And this gets back to what I was mentioning earlier, as far as so much of this being a phenomenon that emerges from the interaction between people's individual genetic predisposition and the surrounding environment. And so you could have people on one end who are genetically wired up to have relatively less of a compensatory appetite response to calorie restriction and weight loss, such that when they lost the initial 12 kilos, they didn't have massive increases in their appetite. And perhaps they also did not see substantial decreases in their spontaneous activity and energy expenditure and things like that, right? So that would be the ideal combination for somebody to succeed on this kind of a plan. Is somebody whose, you know, genetic neurobehavioral kind of predisposition is such that when they lose a bunch of weight through this kind of calorie restriction, they don't have a big increase in their appetite and they don't have a big shutdown in their physical, you know, their activity such that they decrease their energy expenditure. That'll lead to the best outcome. And then you swing all the way to the other end of the spectrum and you can have somebody who's wired up such that if they even start to lose a little bit of weight, they start to get massive increases in their appetite. And if they end up getting all the way to this, you know, average, say, they probably didn't get it that far, if I had to guess, to 12, but say they did, then they would be so ravenously hungry. And potentially in the course of that weight loss, they also shut down so much of their physical activity and decrease their energy expenditure that suddenly they're ready to swing their weight back up in the other direction by 20 kilo weight gain as the top end of that weight regain process happened. Mm. And you could have every combination, permutation, you know, in between. It's just a giant spectrum of how people are going to respond to this intervention, be it in terms of their energy intake and their energy expenditure responses to weight loss. And again,
it's not like the person who had a significant weight regain is like fundamentally a worse person. And the person who sustained or lost a little bit more weight are fundamentally better people. A lot of the variables that impact this stuff, these behavioral responses, are not within their conscious control. And so that's why when we talk about obesity management and things like that, we have a combination of these kind of lifestyle type interventions that should make it as automatic as possible and should make it require as little conscious effort as possible. And then we also can augment with the use of medical treatments that directly target these kind of innate neurological pathways and hit the hypothalamus and hit these other areas that actually drive things like energy intake and energy expenditure type behaviors.
Yeah. Yeah. I think if the assumption here based on, like, you know, the amino-static model is that if you lose lean body mass, you're likely to be hungrier later on as a sort of compensatory mechanism to restore the amount of fat-free mass that you lost, then it makes sense that folks who lost less or even gained some are going to be less likely to be less hungry, you know, after the intervention is over. And if certainly as they are able to maintain that amount of lean body mass. In addition, we know that resistance training, well, exercise in general, and then resistance training in particular, seems to sensitize folks to satiety signals. So when people ask, like, does exercise work for weight loss? And the answer is, well, kind of, in that it tends to make folks a little bit more sensitive to the feelings of fullness, the satiety signals. In addition, it also seems to reduce the decrease in total daily energy expenditure that we see when folks lose weight, because there's a reduction in this sort of muscle economy effect. Basically, you gain a little bit more muscle, so it's more expensive for you to move around. So the reduction in metabolic rate and subsequent total daily energy expenditure seems to be a little bit less. And so from a mechanistic standpoint, this makes perfect sense to me. And now we have some clinical data kind of validating that. And so what can we do about this, right? Well, so thing one, if somebody's asking, like, what's better for weight loss or weight maintenance would be a better question. What type of exercise, aerobic training or resistance training? Answer, both. We want everybody to meet or exceed the current physical activity guidelines. That means lifting. That means doing your conditioning. Do both. Anyway, I can make a strong case. We know that muscle mass is important for function, independent function in particular, and living a long, healthy life with compressed morbidity. So got to lift, do that. Do your conditioning, do both. Also gain some muscle mass. It seems to be very, very important. And resistance training is the best way to gain muscle mass. Also, when it comes to rate of weight loss, I think we can make a strong case for a more gradual approach, because we don't want people to lose a bunch of lean body mass. And so if you were trying to set somebody up for losing the most amount of lean body mass as possible, you'd put them on a very, very large calorie restriction with no resistance training and have it be at low protein. And it's like, that seems like an excellent way to lose lean body mass. So, like, let's not do any of those things. but you see that all the time. And so it's like, all right, what if this study was done with a more moderate sort of energy reduction, energy deficit? And it's like, well, maybe you wouldn't lose as much muscle mass, and maybe the groups would be tighter, diet alone versus diet and aerobic training versus diet and resistance training. And like, what if you had people do diet and resistance training and aerobic training? What would those results be? So we'll have to wait for more data on that, you know, to feel super confident. But I feel very comfortable in recommending that folks eat enough protein, meet the current physical activity guidelines, and then with respect to sort of managing their weight after a period of weight loss, like, do a maintenance phase. I would do all of those things. But again, I'm not reinventing anything. People who got all the way to the end of this podcast and hear that, they're like, well, come on, Feigenbaum. That's what you've been saying all along. And I'm like, yeah, not trying to lead you astray. And it's interesting that you and I very rarely, like, have these podcasts where we're like, this new incredible finding that changes everything. It's like, no. Kind of like the stuff we've been talking about, and just keep talking about it.
I mean, to some extent, and even when we see things that come up that conflict or that cause us to revise a position, it's rarely like just a wholesale upheaval of everything we've ever believed. Usually it's just like, okay, we still, and because this came up in, like, we keep coming back to this damn seed oil post that caused a lot of argument, but people will be like, well, here's this paper. And it's like, again, we draw our conclusions based on the totality of available evidence on a particular topic. Mm-hmm. And so if there is almost no evidence on something, then you really don't have much to go on, and you shouldn't be that confident with any conclusion. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's thing one. If there's a very large body of evidence on something and it all tends to consistently point in one direction, then you can be very confident in conclusions there. And that's kind of how we feel about, you know, a lot of the lipid cholesterol related stuff that we talk about. If there's a large body of evidence and it's all pointing in all sorts of different directions, then you probably shouldn't be that confident about things. And you shouldn't let any one new paper that comes out really strongly sway you in a particular direction, because again, the overall body of evidence is, you know, might be pointing in multiple different directions. And so that's why if people are looking for just like, again, the new latest thing that you should supplement to, you know, completely transform your life or something, like, ain't going to get it here, because just rarely is there going to be something that new that comes out in the scientific literature that just like causes us to just flip the table over and say, everybody has to know about this right now. I'm changing everything that I do.
Can you imagine though, being tasked with doing that every week or multiple times per week so that you could maintain your audience and your, and who you were advertising to, you know, is that it?
I can imagine a few people who do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Well, not here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. This has been episode 184. Thanks to Dr. Austin Baraki for joining me. Austin, we'll get you on the podcast again. I'm super excited that you're in your new place. I assume that you're going to be building out a massive recording studio because this is so near and dear to your heart.
Totally.
Yeah. Let us know what you want to hear about next. So you guys can tweet at us, Barbell Medicine on Twitter, or reach us on any of the socials if you search Barbell Medicine. Before you go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. Again, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. Thanks to Dr. Austin Baraki for joining me. We'll see you here next week on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. See ya.